a great chance. You should be thrilled.
Thrilled? There could be a death penalty.
Not for the lawyer.
Seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer.
Ladytrons and Gentlebots.
Objection. In the absence of pants, defense and suspenders serve no purpose.
I'm going to allow them for now.
Thank you.
I may be a simple country apple chicken, but I know when we're finger-licked. What do you say we plead insanity?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 49. Always cool when we hit a square number there. And this is your square host, Thomas Smith, and your unsquare host, Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew?
I could not be happier.
Yeah, Andrew found like a Commodore 64 lying around that he finally could use to record audio, and it's not having all the audio hiccups that were giving us fits. So speaking of audio fits, last week we posted the Lot Awful Movies number 4, and if you're not sure what that's about, check out The Firm if you haven't already in the main feed. That was a Lot Awful Movies we released to everybody, but normally what we do is we do one a month for patrons only. And so if you pledge $2 or more, you get access to, it's usually a long recording. It probably gets you through the whole month, just kind of off and on. And this was no different. The movie was changing lanes. We had my brother Sam over from Comedy Shoeshine on to make it funny. And it was great. It was an excellent pick. I'm going to give even another shout out to Sharon Frankel for finding that movie for us. It was like the perfect legal movie to make fun of. So go check that out.
Yeah. Changing Lanes was atrocious as a movie. It's almost unwatchable, but it may be worse on the law. We discussed this on Lot Awful Movies. It may be worse on the law than The Firm. It's of the same category, but it's a less, you've got to see it.
Yeah, That's great. All right, let's get to our first listener question of the day.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Listener Jody asks us, I have a small legal matter that I can't afford a real lawyer for. What does Andrew think of using something like LegalZoom?
Yeah. So, Jody.
It's the best thing ever, and it fully replaces lawyers, and Andrew is obsolete. I'm actually thinking of doing the show with LegalZoom. Like, I can fill Andrew's shoes with like a form, like a pre-filled out form.
I actually wrote a blog post on LegalZoom about a year ago that I will link in the show notes. And what I did was I took a very basic service, one that, as I say in the blog post, you can probably do yourself, you know, with a fair amount of confidence. It's not hard. It was organizing an LLC. And when I had finished going through LegalZoom with all of their sort of upsells and options and clicking off the ones that I thought an average person would decline, LegalZoom was going to bill me $1,200 to start my LLC. It was, you can, you know, track the journey that I took through. You can play around with it yourself. Just don't get to the point where you actually put in a credit card. That's like three times.
How did they get up to $1,200?
Yeah, well, because what they do is they make themselves the resident agent, so everything goes through that. They want to sell you on putting together an operating agreement, which, you know, you may not be required in your state, and if you have only one member of the LLC, you know, you probably don't need an operating agreement with yourself, you know.
Yeah.
So we were at literally like 3 to 5 times what hiring a quality lawyer would cost you. And the worst part is you still have to fill out all the forms yourself, right? Like they're basically taking prepackaged forms, making you answer the questions, and then charging you a ton of money for it. And you can hear it in my voice. Like I really feel passionately about this. Like we know, I mean, one of the reasons that I left sort of the big firm environment is this kind of mismatch right now in the law where people like me get funneled into big law firms at exorbitant rates such that, you know, only Fortune 500 companies can afford us. And everybody else is kind of left either scrambling or using LegalZoom or, you know, how many of our listeners, go ahead, put your hands up. We can't see you, but we know this happens. Like, download a form off the internet and, you know, well, I need a contract, so I'll just go searching for, you know, landlord contract and download it off the internet and change a couple of terms. And no, I have no idea what paragraph 47 on that means, but you know, it was on the internet and how bad can it be? Mm-hmm. Right. Part of why I did this was to, Jody, if please do not use LegalZoom. I would say, let me say it this way. How about for 10 people, if you email me, if you're thinking about using LegalZoom for a standard task, right? Like forming an LLC or reviewing a contract, something that would take a couple of hours of lawyer time and you're nervous about that, email me, patorres@patorres.com. Put like LegalZoom or something in the title. For the next 10 listeners, whatever, if you're going to do that, I will charge you a half hour of my discounted rate, right? I will charge you $200 for that task. I would rather have you do that. I can't say I'll do this forever, but I would really rather put in 3 or 4 hours, charge you a half an hour, then see people go off and do something in a box.
Yeah, because you end up paying, sounds like, well, okay, first off, sounds like we're giving up LegalZoom as a potential sponsor ever. So that's, so LegalZoom will never be a sponsor of this show. So because Andrew would have to completely change his tone and he'd lose all credibility. One day it would just be like, oh, you know, I was right. They had a new feature now and now they're great.
they have this new feature where they actually give you advice and don't require you to do it all yourself.
So, but I think it sounds like it's a real half measure. Like it's something that kind of helps you get like a little bit of the paperwork correct, except you still do it all yourself and end up paying sometimes even more than just a normal lawyer. And having someone, the great thing about a lawyer and just any, I would say this about any professional, when you actually talk to a person is like, they'll oftentimes just answer a lot of your questions and stuff that you don't realize is a real value, but they kind of just do it because they're already working for you anyway, you know? And so I would encourage people, take advantage of this deal that Andrew's offering, because it sounds like LegalZoom is not a good way to do this, and have the peace of mind to know if you need a contract or if you need some sort of whatever it is filed, that someone is doing it actually tailored to you specifically, and they're not just giving you a form and then having you still mail it and do all the, or fill it out and do all the that crap.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Hey, no problem. I think that if there's anything that Andrew Torres deserves on this show for all his hours and hours of expertise he's giving us, it would be for him to talk shit on LegalZoom for it not being not being a solution to problems. So patorres@patorres.com, right?
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Take advantage, you guys. Maybe you probably, yeah, maybe I'll take advantage of this. Maybe I'm going to file
you have.
I know, I totally have. And that's the thing. Like, if that wouldn't be true, if it turned out that LegalZoom actually were the better way to do it, Andrew would have told me personally, like, nah, don't use me. but no, I use Andrew as well. Great lawyer. All right, commercial over, unless there's anything else we need to cover in that question.
No.
Worthwhile. All right, Andrew, it's time to get to our main topic of the day. Pretty excited about this one. You have talked from time to time about originalism. We've covered it here and there. You've given your take on Scalia a number of times. It's spoiler alert to anyone who doesn't know, any new listeners maybe. Not a fan. Not a fan, yeah. And you've convinced me. I'm not a fan as well. It didn't take much, but you've convinced me. But there is much there, by the way. There's a lot of good reason to not have been a Scalia fan. But anyway, so this, what we wanted to talk about today, though, is maybe covering just originalism in itself, I think. Is that right? Because you've covered it here and there as regards different kind of decisions and as it was made manifest in Scalia's decisions. But today, you wanted to talk about just what is originalism, right?
Right. And in particular, I have taken the position that I think any would-be Supreme Court justice who describes their judicial philosophy as originalist or textualist is not qualified to serve on the Supreme Court, and not unqualified because of a lack of intellectual temperament, but unqualified because that view is not consistent with the Constitution. And the analogy I've made elsewhere is, you know, if you were a Marxist, or, you know, I took a class called Critical Legal Studies that was about radical deconstruction of the law with a professor named Duncan Kennedy, who's brilliant. He's much smarter than I am. But his legal philosophy is essentially that, you know, the law has no fixed meaning and reflects, you know, sort of a Richard Rorty, Michel Foucault type power struggle. Like, it's super interesting. If he were on the Supreme Court, I'm sure I would agree with 99% of his opinions. He doesn't belong in the Supreme Court because his judicial philosophy is not consistent with the Constitution. And we have defended on this show what I consider a self-described textualist in Seth Barrett Tillman come on the show. And, you know, he conceded that this is by far the majority view of jurisprudence is, you know, sort of what I would call the ordinary stare decisis model that says judges are bound by prior precedent and they look to previous cases to form the boundaries in how particular constitutional provisions are to be interpreted. And
let me challenge you a little bit on this, sure, though, because I think that some people, I think even liberals might ask this question. I can imagine any conservatives listening would certainly probably ask this question. Is it unfair to call it disqualifying because it's not the majority view? If I were to just do some simplistic math and say, like, well, what kind of percentage are we talking about? Is it 10%? Is it whatever? There's 9 justices, right? I mean, couldn't there be 1 or 2 or however many that represent that sort of school of jurisprudence? Is it unreasonable to have even 1 or 2 that are that? Why is it so bad that it's disqualifying?
No, I think that's an awesome question, because we tend to think of seats on the Supreme Court as occupying the left-right spectrum because everything is politicized these days. This was not the case as recently as 25 years ago, right? I mean, David Souter was a George H.W. Bush appointee. He was widely considered to be sort of conservative in temperament and had a history of reaching some conservative outcomes when he was I believe he was in New Hampshire. He was either on the First Circuit or on the New Hampshire Supreme Court, possibly both. So we tend to think of it like that. So you tend to think, well, okay, well, you know, what does it hurt to have an originalist on the court, right? Like, what does it hurt to have 4 conservatives on the court or whatever? The argument that it is a minority position is not shorthand for, and the majority ought to win. It is rather the overwhelming majority of people who are lawyers, who think about jurisprudence and go to school and study the Constitution, have come away, in my view, correctly, with the idea that the way in which jurisprudence is to be done, the way in which case law is to be interpreted, is through the ordinary model that I've described, and not through this sort of competing model of originalism for a number of reasons. And I can kind of give you sort of the shorthand. I've given a lot of shorthand kind of public policy arguments, but the fundamental underlying reasons are, number one, that originalism is internally contradictory, right? It says we want to look to the intent of the framers in deciding what constitutional provisions mean. And when you look to what those framers themselves said, you will find that they did not want anything like originalism, right?
Oh, really?
So
do we want to get into that evidence yet, or do you want to save that for later? But I guess my question would be, what is the evidence that the founders would have been against originalism? But it's up to you when we want to tackle that.
Maybe this is instructive. Like, Thomas, if I asked you to define originalism, how would you do that? Like,
all right. Well, based on, I listen to the show called Opening Arguments. I don't know if you've heard of it, but I've learned quite a bit about the law. You know, I'm doing okay on the bar exam. not doing great. We'll find out how good I'm doing today, I guess. But I would say that it's the overall thing is You're using the what you think the founders intended with the language of the Constitution, and it seems to, in general, minimize the importance of jurisprudence throughout the years. So you think that any evidence of the founders is far more, and what the founders thought is far more instructive than, say, a case from 1870 and then 1910 and then 1950, and pretty much the closer to now things get, the less important they are when using an originalist philosophy. How close am I?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. Originalists, like when we had Seth Barrett Tillman on, they tend to appropriate for themselves the label of textualist, and their argument there is that jurisprudence is based on the text of the provision of the Constitution or the law in question. And so the additional sort of corollary that I would put on that is they would say, if what you do is you look at the words of a particular provision in the Constitution and you try and figure out what those words mean. And you would look first to, do they have an ordinary agreed upon dictionary definition? And then secondly, do they have a specialized definition that was given to them by the founding fathers, by the framers, by whoever wrote it? And so, you know, those two things sort of coexist. We tend to focus on the latter, but the dictionary definition also leads, in my view, to some sort of absurd results and is kind of equally not what the founders intended. But I realized that I've been sort of giving a shorthand for why originalism leads to some absurd results, right? So, for example, like we've talked about the Eighth Amendment, which forbids cruel and unusual punishment. There is a Scalia opinion that says, well, it forbids cruel and unusual punishment. And via the, you know, ordinary meaning of those words, if a punishment is cruel but usual, or, you know, unusual but not particularly cruel, then it would not be excluded. And the way then in which we would further parse that interpretation of the Eighth Amendment, according to Scalia, is to look at the kinds of punishments that were prohibited by the government in the 18th century, right, in 1791. And if you look at that, you wind up with a position that no human being could possibly defend, right? Like public whippings, floggings, pillories, putting people in the stocks. And in fact, it was Nina Totenberg who asked Scalia in a 2008 interview if, under his view of the Eighth Amendment, it would be permitted to put people back in the stocks. And since Scalia was already on the Supreme Court and not going through a nomination process, this was his answer. I want to read it and then get this exactly right. So, quote, "I would say that that may be very stupid," he told Nina Totenberg, quote, "but it is not unconstitutional if indeed it was a punishment that was at the time accepted," end of quote. And so I have said this elsewhere. I think during the Gorsuch nomination fight, I hope we have staffers or members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who listen to the show. They should ask Neil Gorsuch what he thinks the Eighth Amendment means. They should read this quote in from Antonin Scalia and force him to either agree with it or repudiate it. Now, Supreme Court justices lie in their confirmation hearings.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, it should be a part of the public debate, because there is no way to be an originalist and not come away with the conclusion that it's perfectly fine to have public floggings and put people in the stocks. Now, that's a good public policy argument. But one of the reasons I wanted to do this show is I could very well imagine if Scalia were here or you know, Professor Tillman were back on saying, look, that's not a complete argument, right? Like, suppose that's what the Constitution means, right? Like, suppose the Constitution doesn't prohibit flogging. Suppose it doesn't prohibit breaking on the wheel. Like, you may wish it did, but that doesn't prove that that's how we ought to interpret the Constitution, right? Just because you reach an outcome you don't want. So I wanted to explain why I think originalism is intellectually bankrupt as well as what I would describe as morally bankrupt.
Yeah, I do remember Seth Tillman using that argument a couple times where it's like, well, I know you all want the Emoluments Clause to be apply to presidents, but if it doesn't, that's not an argument that, you know, we should interpret things differently just because it doesn't reach the conclusion that we all kind of want. So I think That's a good guess as to how they might respond.
Well, that plays into the general like conservative liberal argument to begin with, right? So I want to fight them on their terms, right? So let's do that. I've already kind of flagged that first argument that I think that this is internally contradictory, and by that I mean if you prioritize the writings of the founding fathers in interpreting provisions of the Constitution, then when you turn to those very writings, you will not find the founding fathers saying, our words are what govern what these provisions mean. So we turn, for example, to the Federalist Papers, right? Like the Federalist Papers were written by the founders to argue in favor of ratifying the Constitution, which includes Article 3, which sets forth the judiciary and the powers of the Supreme Court. And in Federalist 78, that's the first paper that deals with the judiciary. Here's what Alexander Hamilton says. He says, the complete independence of the courts of justice is peculiarly essential in a limited constitution. By a limited constitution, I understand one which contains specified exceptions to the legislative authority, such as no ex post facto laws, right? And this is the critical part. Limitations of this kind can be preserved in practice no other way than through the medium of courts of justice, whose duty it must be to declare all acts contrary to the, quote, manifest tenor of the Constitution void. Without this, all the reservations of particular rights or privileges would amount to nothing. So that looks pretty solidly like the argument that I've been making, right? And in fact, it's part of why I make the argument that I do, right? Hamilton says, look, the way in which we have an independent judiciary that provides a check on the legislative is that the judiciary looks at laws and says, are these laws consistent with the tenor of the Constitution? And if you want to go textualist, right, I've made this point before, the Constitution, by and large, contains very few provisions that are specific and clear in their application, right? It contains the Third Amendment about quartering soldiers, and we've talked about that. Mm-hmm. But by and large, it contains terms like in the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, right? And so, you know, as I've asked rhetorically before, like, you know, what's a liberty? How do you get deprived of it? What's a process? How much of it are you due, right? And you see from Hamilton's writings here that that creates a, quote, tenor to the Constitution or a manifest tenor.
I was going to ask, I thought you were going to say, let's do a dictionary definition. What is a tenor of the Constitution? Right, right. Let's get all textual on it.
Yeah. Well, and let me explain. You might say, okay, well, you know, Andrew, you're doing the same thing that the originalists do. You've pulled out one quote from Hamilton. Well, let's go a little further in that same Federalist 78. Hamilton says, a constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them, that is the judges, to ascertain its meaning, as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. If there should happen to be an irreconcilable variance between the two, that which has the superior obligation and validity ought to be preferred. In other words, the constitution ought to be preferred against the statute and the intention of the people to the intention of their agents. And I think that last part is really significant because that's who the founders are, right? Those are the agents of the people. And so when we hear various originalists say, well, you know, we want to prize, you know, what did George Washington do in this situation? What did the founders describe in this particular situation? Hamilton says, no, we want the exact opposite, right? We want the general spirit of the will of the people as embodied in the Constitution to take precedence over what we say, because, you know, we're just agents of the people. I think that's pretty clear. But you might say, well, you know, like this is sort of flowery language. The further argument I would give on the contradiction is when you look to the decisions that the Supreme Court made in the first 30 years of the Republic, while the framers were still alive, right? You don't see anything like what you would see if there was an understanding at the time that the framers' intent was what ruled, right? So, for example, right, we've talked obliquely about Marbury versus Madison. That's the 1804 Supreme Court decision that established the right of judicial review. Right? The Supreme Court refused to issue a writ of mandamus appointing Marbury as a judge, as a justice of the peace, actually, and instead said, it is our obligation to declare laws void when they run contrary to the Constitution. It's the first time the Supreme Court did that. And in that opinion, you will not find a single reference to the intent of the framers in drafting Article 3, right? What you will find is a lengthy discussion of the purpose of Article 3 and the point of an independent judiciary. In other words, you will find precisely the manifest tenor of the Constitution. You will find the idea that these words establish guiding principles that then it is left for the judiciary to interpret and apply going forward. So I think you put all of that together, and I don't know what the counter argument to that would be, right? Like, if you say, we care about what the framers did, we care about what the founding fathers wanted to do, you can look at their writings and you can look at the people who knew them, who served on the Supreme Court, and neither of them did what people like Scalia and Gorsuch say they should have been doing, if indeed originalism is the right way to view the Constitution.
You know, the only thing I can think of that's this might be a little bit of an abstract question, so apologies, but could you also say that in some ways, your version of, or in the mainstream version of jurisprudence, could be contradictory, because if enough justices took the originalism view and started ruling in that way, would that become mainstream jurisprudence because it's in the jurisprudence? Like, you would start looking at those originalist decisions and decide, oh, people have adapted over time to start using an originalist method of interpreting the law, therefore we ought to go with that precedent.
Yeah, no.
Could your version be rendered kind of self-contradictory as well?
Yeah, well, absolutely. It could be rendered, you could do an end run around the traditional method of jurisprudence by doing exactly that. That's why it is critical that the Senate do its duty and keep people with an originalist philosophy off of the courts. Yeah, right. Like, in our discussion last week of the Fourth Circuit handgun ban case, right? Like, we described kind of precisely that difficulty that you face if you are a believer in the mainstream view of jurisprudence, because you're stuck with D.C. versus Heller as binding Supreme Court precedent, and you can look at it and go, gosh, this is bad. We're going to do a future episode on, you know, sort of truly atrocious Supreme Court decisions. But you know, my old boss, Judge Radowski on the Maryland Court of Appeals, I asked him, he never wrote dissents in cases. And I asked him what it took for him to write a dissent. And he said, if I can taste the bile in the back of my throat when I read the majority's opinion, then I might dissent, but not before that. And you know, that's true to a much greater degree when you're talking about wanting to just disregard precedent, right? To say, you know, like we did in Brown versus Board of Education, no, I'm sorry, Plessy v. Ferguson was wrongly decided. It really takes kind of a monumental shift to go, yeah, that was just wrong. And I don't think, right, as you look at D.C. versus Heller, which is the 2008 Scalia-authored opinion that found a broad, sweeping individual rights view of the Second Amendment, it's a real tension for somebody that has the mainstream view of jurisprudence to look at it and go, yeah, that seems wrongly decided, but like, am I overstepping my bounds as a judge on the as a justice on the Supreme Court to say, I'm going to go back and overrule a case from 2008, right? Like, so yes, look, like, that's why this philosophy was designed, right? It was deliberately crafted by Robert Bork in the 1970s to do this end run, to if you have enough justices following this philosophy, then you will wind up with these kind of crazy activist opinions. And then it doesn't matter, right? Like, now you've gotten your foothold in the door, and now you have two ways to win, right? Like, you can win either by maintaining an originalist majority on the court that doesn't care about precedent, or by having a majority that abides by precedent, but you've now, you know, sort of littered the landscape with these terrible precedents. So I agree that that's a that that's a problem, but I think that that's a designed feature of originalism to kind of, you know, serve as a virus in that way, if you will.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that dovetails sort of nicely with what I would describe as the second main argument against originalism as a judicial philosophy, and the reason why it must be kept off the court, and that is originalism really tears down the checks and balances that are meant to be on the powers of the judiciary, right? So what do I mean by that? If you are obligated to follow past precedent, that sets limits, positive and negative, as to what you can do, right? Can you push the boundaries of those limits? Absolutely, right? So like we looked at the, again, to kind of go back to the recent Fourth Circuit opinion on Maryland's assault weapons ban, they said, look, DC versus Heller sets forth a broad individual right to keep and bear arms, but by its own terms, it does not apply to weapons of war, right? So that means anything that that we think that we're going to uphold as not implicating the Second Amendment is consistent with Heller if, in turn, those things are weapons of war, right? So it provided... I mean, that was a way to distinguish Heller, but you couldn't just say, well, we know Heller says that it's weapons of war. These are not weapons of war, but nevertheless, you know, we want to ban them anyway. Like that, the court had to go through. They were constrained in the power of the outcome that they could reach, regardless of how prudent they thought the law was, because of the prior cases. That's what precedent does, is it says we've set forth markers, right? So if Maryland had, for example, banned handguns, one of the things Maryland did ban in the early 1990s was so-called Saturday night specials, which were super cheap handguns, and there was thought to be a strong public policy reason for doing that, which was that they were inaccurate. They were like flooding the street. So, you know, they weren't safe. And, you know, there were sort of all of these public policy reasons against it. You could not have reached the result that the Fourth Circuit reached under a Saturday night special ban, right? Because cheap handguns are not at all analogous to weapons of war, right? They just aren't. So in light of Heller, you would not have been able to reach that outcome because of the prior cases. So, so it provides a real check against the judges sort of doing whatever the hell they want. When your touchstone is, what did the founding fathers think in 1789? There's almost nothing that serves as a bulwark against, you know, using the founding fathers as a ventriloquist dummy, because the historical records of that are incredibly sparse. And part of the reason they're sparse is that was that first argument, right? Like that you don't have the words of the founders preserved in jurisprudence in early Supreme Court cases because they didn't think that was dispositive. And so because of that, I mean, you might remember Professor Tillman coming on and saying, with respect to the Emoluments Clause, like, yes, I'd like to have a larger discussion about historians here, right? Like, well, like, lawyers aren't historians, right? Like the reason you want to do that is because, you know, you are searching for these, you know, tiny little signposts. And if what you're doing is searching for something that you expect the record to be thin, that provides very little constraint on the outcome that you can reach as a judge, right? So if you have sort of the more mainstream view, right? So let's go back to the Eighth Amendment for an example.
All right.
If we say that the Eighth Amendment is meant to protect against cruel and unusual punishment, and cruel and unusual punishment is meant to have a, as Hamilton would put it, manifest tenor, right? What it means is, yeah, like you can't torture people. You can't do horrible stuff to them. Right. And it's meant to embody the idea that, yeah, like we might not have fully thought through what constitutes horrible stuff right now. But over time, the guiding principle is not what was banned at the time that this amendment was passed. The guiding principle is this punishment horrible? Is it torture? Does it shock the conscience? Is it, you know, whatever kind of moral synonym you would put for cruel and unusual punishment? And then, you know, you might look to, for example, social science research or international law or other pieces of secondary evidence, right? Like, so for example, whenever There is a case arguing that capital punishment violates the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment clause. Those cases inevitably point out that virtually every industrialized society on Earth has prohibited capital punishment, with the exception of the United States, right? Like, that's not to say that their law is dispositive of our law, right? It isn't. It's to say that this helps us understand, right? Like, you're saying we're applying a principle. You can already hear the originalist going, oh, that just means the judges can make up whatever they want. And they would say, no, we're not making up whatever we want. We are looking to, how do we understand what this principle means today?
I was thinking about this Eighth Amendment thing, and I was just thinking, let me know if this might be a good counter argument, but the idea that it hinges on what was in use in 1791. So would Scalia say, we have him on record here as saying that the stocks would be constitutional.
Right.
But even if he's saying, oh, it would be, you know, that would be a stupid punishment. Would he be committed to saying that if there were some 21st century thing that we invented that pretty much does exactly the same thing as stocks, but wasn't around at that time, that that would actually be unconstitutional, just because even though it's still cruel, like he would agree that it's, because his reasoning is, sure, it's cruel, but it wasn't unusual, correct?
Yes.
So if we invented, I don't know, the digital stock, some equivalent of that, which is some new technology or something, let's say it's some new mental stocks, like it just, we're able to tap into your brain with a computer and it just holds you in that position in the same way. Would then that be unconstitutional merely because that wasn't around at the time? But so that therefore it fits the test as cruel and unusual.
And typically, you know, I mean, that's a hilarious example, but I mean, think about it. It comes out when you're talking about First Amendment cases, right? Like there weren't blogs, there weren't podcasts in 1787. So, you know, does freedom of speech for an originalist, you know, only apply to printed newspapers? And typically what they will say is, well, when you have advances in technology, you use the principles articulated by the founders at the time and kind of apply it forward. So, you know, again,
but I think you can't possibly do that if you're reasoning on this Eighth Amendment question, because if your reasoning is it's only what was unusual at the time, you're stuck in time. Like I don't know how he could possibly do that.
I think that's an excellent point, because ordinarily you would say that the question is, well, what would the founders consider cruel and unusual? And we can look to the punishments they permitted as obviously not fitting within that, right? Like that's the argument against the death penalty being prohibited by the Eighth Amendment, right? It says, look, it says right in the Constitution, right in the Eighth Amendment, no person may be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, right? So you can't put somebody in jeopardy of life if you don't have capital punishment. They thought capital punishment was fine, therefore it's not cruel and unusual. The way in which originalists typically get around the time problem is to say, well, what would they consider? But you're absolutely right that I've never thought about this, that for something to be unusual requires you to look at contemporary practice, right? Like that's mm-hmm. the dictionary definition of what constitutes, like by definition, every time you come up with a new punishment, right? It's unusual.
It would be unusual.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's a great point in terms of how you're stuck because of the unique quality of that word. And I think it sort of further goes to serve the larger point that I'm making here, which is, that absurdity shows that we should not be reading the Eighth Amendment as prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment, each of the words defined individually. Like if I said, I want a hot dog, like you wouldn't set my puppy on fire, right? Like we know what a hot dog is.
Or like we shouldn't be reading it like a programmer. Like it's like cruel, like and parentheses, cruel, comma, unusual. Right. Like it has to be both of those, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. I just such an idiotic way. And that actually, that example is, I think, the first thing you used when you were kind of teaching me about this originalist perspective. And what was the case he was talking about when he made that ruling? I can't remember.
The original case that Scalia just tossed to the curb was a case called Solemn versus Helm. And in that case, the Supreme Court set forth what was then called the proportionality doctrine, that basically said a punishment violates this manifest tenor of the Constitution, is cruel and unusual if it's grossly disproportionate to the offense that was committed, right? And in this case, we were talking about states that had three strikes and you're outlaws, right? So, you committed two felonies and your third felony, that's it, strike three, you're out, and they would lock you up, life imprisonment without possibility of parole. And the Supreme Court said the Solem versus Helm involved the crime of passing a bad check. It was like a $500 bad check, so it was a felony. It was the guy's third felony, and he was going to be locked up for life. And the Supreme Court said, quite sensibly, if cruel and unusual means anything, right, it certainly means putting somebody away for 50 years for writing a bad check.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
That's like Les Miserables level punishment.
Literally 7 years later, it was 8 years when the decision came out, but 7 years when Scalia heard a similar case called Harmelin versus Michigan that involved, I think it was a nonviolent drug crime, but it was the exact same principle, right? Three strikes and you're outlaws.
Which is curious that it even got back to the Supreme Court. Like, how was it just the case of Scalia or something, you know, there's enough right-wing presence on the court that they wanted to, you know, re-examine it.
Right. Remember that it only takes four votes for cert. So judges will look and will take a case and say, oh yeah, no, I'd like to take this case, even though it's sort of squarely up against existing precedent, because I'd like to overrule that existing precedent. And and he succeeded in this case. So same principle, mandatory minimum sentence for a nonviolent crime on the third offense. And Scalia just said, in my view, Solem versus Helm doesn't count because what matters is what did the founders think cruel and unusual punishment meant in 1791. And this is where he uttered the famous phrase, severe mandatory minimum penalties for nonviolent offenses may indeed be cruel, quote, but they are not unusual in the constitutional sense, having been employed in various forms throughout our nation's history. Right. So you can see, right, it also answers your question. They did not have a three strikes and you're outlaw in 1791. So he says sort of not just was this punishment unusual, but like, were punishments like this unusual at the time? And he's like, no, like, yeah, in 1791, like, you could be sentenced to jail till the cows come home for all sorts of nonviolent offenses. So therefore, the Eighth Amendment means effectively nothing. Right. Like, in light of absent. Right. If you take away the proportionality doctrine and you take away the prohibition on capital punishment, then it's not clear to me what's left that the Eighth Amendment prohibits other than
by his logic. Yeah. I mean, is there nothing to stop someone? So if, let's say, a certain I don't know what level of government would do this, but whatever it is, a municipality of some kind decides they want to punish shoplifting by life in prison. Nothing stops that, right?
Correct. Like,
literally nothing stops that in Scalia's mind.
Yes, absolutely correct. And look, if this Supreme Court were to invalidate that law, as I think they would have to negotiate around Harmelin versus Michigan, right? Like, they would have to acknowledge
this.
Which
is the Scalia one, or was that the
original
one?
That's the Scalia one, right?
Okay.
They would have to say, well, you know, notwithstanding our result in Harmelin versus Michigan, this violates the Eighth Amendment because, and it would, you know, it would require some tap dancing, or it would require them to, you know, have a Brown versus Board of Education.
I was going to say, I really think in the case of Scalia, there ought to be that emergency...
You ought to be able to take
a
mulligan,
emergency
right?
Exit.
On all of his opinions. But that's right. Like, you know, that's a part of our jurisprudence now, and it's something that contemporary justices have to deal with. And you know, it by filling both prongs, right? Like, look, if the state can kill you, right, in order to meet the cruelty prong, you now have to argue that the punishment is worse than death, right? And look, I could imagine some punishments. Being proposed by this administration, you know, that might necessarily, you know, that might meet that criteria.
But there's no way that's what they intended with the, you know, like, there's no way this would be the intent of this cruel and unusual punishment clause.
To be essentially meaningless. I agree. And that really gets into the third argument, the last argument that I'm going to make on this episode. And that is, when we look to the founding fathers again, because I'm trying to conduct most of this debate not on it's a bad thing to render the Eighth Amendment meaningless, but would the founding fathers want us to render the Eighth Amendment meaningless, right? And to the contrary, you find in the writings of our founding fathers a profound sympathy for the plights of minorities. Now, let me be very, very clear here. They were thinking of minorities as one group of white male property holders, yeah, and majorities being another group of white male property holders, and whether that was going to break down on religious lines or political lines or whatever. Like, you don't find, I do not want to whitewash our nation's history, you do not find sympathy for women and persons of color and what we think of as minorities today, but you do find tremendous sympathy for political minorities, which are not difficult to apply in the same way. Right. So, for example, going back to the Federalist Papers, in Federalist Paper number 10, this was written by Madison, who later became president. Right. So, again, you would think this ought to have some merit to originalists. When he was describing the purpose of the Constitution in the first place, here's how he described the purpose of having a Constitution. He said, "Complaints are everywhere heard from our most considerate and virtuous citizens, equally the friends of public and private faith and of personal and public liberty, that our governments are too unstable, that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority." And so you find the structure proposed in the Federalist Papers adopted in Article 3. Like, there's a reason why Supreme Court justices are given life tenure, why they are appointed and not elected, right? Because the idea was to shield the judiciary from political pressures, to have it be an apolitical body, and not just to have it be an apolitical body, like, because, you know, they were contemplating Democrats and Republicans. We know they weren't, right? Like, in his farewell address, George Washington famously warned against establishing permanent political parties, which, you know, nice if idealistic advice.
I know, if only.
They weren't thinking about political parties. They weren't thinking about, like, a political body is a bad thing. They were thinking the political bodies, right? The Congress was responsive to the needs of the majority. And so they wanted to put in checks to make sure there were branches of government that were responsive to the needs of the minority. And that's clear beyond a shadow of a doubt. And I would debate any originalist, wants to come on the show to discuss this principle. It is clear beyond a shadow of a doubt. That's the original intent of the judiciary, is to protect against the majority just doing whatever they want in the legislature. That's why we enshrine these principles in the Constitution and particularly in the Bill of Rights. And that itself, has a rich history in our law. So, for example, all the lawyers who are listening will know the case of United States versus Caroline Products. This is 304 U.S. 144. It's a 1938 decision, right? So it's 80 years old at this point. And footnote 4 of that decision, it's been called the most famous footnote in jurisprudence, right, says that the primary purpose of the court is to protect against, quote, prejudice against discrete and insular minorities that may be a special condition which tends seriously to curtail the operation of those political processes ordinarily to be relied upon to protect minorities, and which may call for a correspondingly more searching judicial inquiry, right? That footnote provided kind of the roadmap to all of the subsequent opinions that we rely upon today that incorporate the Bill of Rights to the state and that vindicate the rights of individuals, particularly the rights of minorities against the government, to say, hey, look, if you are a discrete and insular minority, that is, if you are African Americans in this country, you may be permanently disenfranchised in the sense that You may never obtain majority status for your group. And it may be easier for, you know, 80% of the country to enact conditions on a 20% insular minority. And that's contrary to the Constitution. And that's the job that the judiciary was meant to protect. They were meant to be the bulwark against a majority oppressing a minority. And so, you know, all of these originalist decisions, the net effect have been to roll back the rights of individuals, particularly the rights of individuals who fall into these, you know, discrete and insular minorities. And, you know, if you think about it, right, like if the touchstone is what was prohibited, what did the founding fathers want to do at the time, right? Like, well, 1791 was not a good time to be a discrete and insular minority in this country, right? You are putting your thumb, you're putting your entire body and a, you know, lead weight on the side of the scale in favor of entrenching the rights of majorities. And it's just...
Yeah, I'd be curious to ask an originalist if they think that this doesn't hinder moral progress. And I would want to ask, like, you think we are capable of making moral progress, right, as a species? And if so, how in the world are we ever to do that legally, to adjust our legal instruments to keep up with moral progress if we're bound by whatever these old dead guys from the 1790s exactly meant with their words?
I think they would dispute that premise, right? Like, I think, so number one, you have a strong overlap with religious conservatives who there's no such thing as moral progress, right? Like, there is a uniform and invariant moral law that never changes.
Which is insane, of course.
Well, you asked the argument I'm trying to give it. Secondarily, I think they would say, and to the extent that it does change and it becomes a consensus, then, you know, let's go to the legislature to make that happen. Let's not go to unelected judges who are just going to say what they think are moral consensuses, right? Like, that's their argument. And the response back to that is the whole...
Well, it wouldn't work in every case. Like, I get that it would work in some cases. You could legislate kind of on top of the Constitution. But if moral progress ever contradicted what someone thinks the founders meant, then you could never beat that, right?
Yeah, I forget who it was that said the First Amendment. It might have been Frederick Schauer, but he said the First Amendment protects deeply unpopular speech. Indeed, that's the only speech for which it is necessary, right? Yeah. Popular speech needs no protection, right? And I would extend that aphorism to all of our rights. Like, if you were talking about, you know, the rights that are enjoyed by the majority and appreciated by the majority, like, that's precisely the kind of rights that don't need protecting, right? Like, those are the rights that are well established and for which you're not in danger of the legislature taking them away. When I take all of that together, I think it is profoundly dangerous. We have three committed originalists on the court right now, and adding a fourth, in my view, is profoundly dangerous.
On that depressing note,
look, like, let's get that out there, right? Like, the idea, it's why you and I wanted to do this show. I think we both, you know, sort of felt like, you know, we wanted to contribute to the debate and dialogue. This is not an argument that's being made in liberal circles, and it should be. And I feel very.
I think it's become too normalized because of how you've already got three originalists on the highest court in the land. So it's like it's already normal to people. It doesn't seem like the outrageous thing that it really should be.
The last thing is from a political perspective, right? Like, you can follow the mainstream theory of jurisprudence and be, you know, more liberal, more conservative, right? Like, the discussion over how quote liberal is Merrick Garland. Like, we don't really know. Like, but what we know is that he abides by the mainstream theory of jurisprudence. Anthony Kennedy, right? Like, he has reached a great many very conservative opinions. But the reason why he's a swing justice is because he's not an originalist, right? And it does not constrain the power of the president to appoint sort of like-minded individuals and justices that have reached conservative outcomes, but who nevertheless recognize the importance of binding precedent, who don't have what is, in my view, a disqualifying ideology. So I just wanted to add that.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks for taking us through that. As usual, I mean, I've already been convinced, because that the cruel and unusual thing was really convinced me about Scalia. It's just such an absurd thing in my view. But thanks for taking us more in depth on originalism.
Yeah, thank you for letting me rant.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no, I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
All right, it's time to thank our new patrons here on New Patron Tuesday. Thank you so much to those who went to patreon.com/law. Again, $2 and up patrons. I really hope you enjoyed this Lot Awful Movies. It was, by the way, a lot of work put into getting it out. I know it was a little bit late, but I blame February, the worst month ever conceived by humans. But it was a heroic effort, and it put a lot of time into it. It's really funny. Check it out. And speaking of the fine, fine patrons who are going to enjoy Lot Awful Movies this month, Steve Andrews, Justin Chubb, Eric Johnson, Teresa Gant, Absion, Greg Sullivan, Baphom. Sorry, I can't pronounce that. BF. I've never seen that before. Baphom. Pascal Romero, Danny Mannion, James Klassen, Heather Walter, Zachary B. Foss Gonzalez, Mimel, Burz Molly, Elias Garcia, Brendan Kirby, and Sean Tracy. Take it away, Andrew.
Yeah, and thank you to Nick Ward, to Zach Jablons, Zach Cam, Robert, Reven, Wingy. Thank you to Giro1369, to Christopher Dalp, to M, to Conrad Syke, John, and thank you to Null. We appreciate all of your fine patronage.
Yeah, I would say that's an error, but you know, Null is still giving us, you know, $2, so it must not be an error. There's no way we can get $2 from an error.
Oh, this could be the plot of Brewster's Millions, right? Like,
I don't know. Sorry, still haven't seen.
No, no. I meant Superman 3, an Office Space, right?
Oh, Superman 3. Yeah, I love that.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, it is time to find out if I go 8 for 13 or 7 for 13. And there's a pretty big difference there. I'm hoping it's the former. So how about it, Andrew? Let's hear the answer to last week's TTTBE.
Okay, this was another hearsay question. This was a man in a beach chair in a relaxed state who watches a truck race down on the sand and run down a sunbathing elderly person. And the man shouts out loud, "Oh God, look what that truck driver did. He was racing and going about 100 miles an hour. Somebody call 911. And then the woman who was on the beach but facing the other way heard the first man's outcry. And so the question was, when the case comes to trial, will the court allow both the man and the woman to testify about what the man said, right? So obviously the man can testify. It's his personal observation. Why would you want to have the woman testify in that situation? Because, you know, perhaps there are problems with the first man as a witness, right? Mm. Being able to introduce the statement through somebody else, like sometimes there are strategic reasons for doing that. So the question
really?
Is—
Really? Okay. Now I'm doubting myself because I didn't understand there'd be any reason for that, but okay.
Right. So it obviously this is hearsay as to the woman, right? The woman heard the man say, "Oh my God, he went 100 miles an hour," right? Mm-hmm. So ordinarily, as you know, hearsay is not admissible. So this question was testing whether this fit into any of the exceptions to the hearsay rule. And our options were option A, yes, both can testify because it's an excited utterance. And that's an exception to the hearsay rule that goes to a material issue of the case. B was, yes, this is not hearsay, and it is not being entered for the truth of the statement by either witness, so they can both testify. That is another sort of way around hearsay, is to say, I am not offering the statement for the truth of the matter contained in the statement, but I'm offering it for another purpose. And we can talk about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, what other? That one seems like it's got to be wrong, but okay, moving on.
C is no, neither of them can testify because the man was impaired due to being too relaxed from his meditation. We laughed at this one. And the woman cannot repeat the utterances. I feel like it's going to end up being
that one, and I'm suing you for misleading me, but go on.
Of an impaired witness. No, it's still funny. And D is no, neither can testify because the utterances do not fit any of the exceptions to the hearsay rule. And Thomas, you picked D.
Come on. No brainer.
Which analyzed the question correctly, but unfortunately is incorrect. The statement qualifies as an excited utterance when you blurt something out in response to a shocking condition. And certainly watching an old guy get run over on the beach is a shocking condition. This, you know, sort of goes back 800 years at common law that the problem with hearsay is that it's thought to be unreliable, and it largely is. But there are certain conditions that have arisen as exceptions where we think there is an indicia of reliability. Like in an accident, somebody comes out and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. This was all my fault." Right. Later, they might recant that, but you might want to put them on the stand. You might want to not put them on the stand. You might want to admit their statement as hearsay because we have this notion that, you know, when people are shocked, they tend to call out the truth. Now, psychological literature actually disputes that. But nevertheless, excited utterance is an exception to the hearsay rule. It goes to the material issue of the case. This is an exception. So A is the correct answer, I am sorry to say.
Bah, bah, bah. So what does that leave me? 7 for 13?
7 for 13.
It's about time for me to hang up my robes. I don't have what it takes. Yeah, that sucks. I mean, I think I psyched myself too much with just how pointless this testimony would be, because I still need to remember, like, even if testimony would be pointless, it's still admissible. Like, I gotta start thinking in terms of like that. I think that could be my problem.
This tested, do you know the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule? And, you know, in the absence of knowing, and I know you studied hard in law school.
Yeah.
You were top five in your class, but you know, maybe you missed that day in evidence. So.
Yeah. Well, maybe the top four in my class would get it, but that's the dividing line.
It's a tough line.
Yeah. Well, that's unfortunate. All right. Well, thanks for playing to everyone who submitted questions. Oh, and Andrew, future Andrew, who is our lucky winner this week?
Okay, past Thomas. This week's winner is April Poff at VADAWN, VADAWN 13 on Twitter. April's a longstanding fan of the show, and she says, going with A for TTTBE, because I have vague memories of hearing the phrase excited utterance back when I used to watch Court TV. Well, good on you for your vague memories. Excited utterance is exactly the correct phrase to have remembered here. That's exactly what this was. So April Poff is our winner. Give her a shout out and follow her at VADAWN 13 on Twitter. And thanks for playing.
Well, that does it for today's show. Thank you so much to all our listeners. Thank you so much to all our patrons over at patreon.com/law. Thank you so much to all our Andrews over at andrew.com/Andrew. And with that said, we will see you guys on Friday.
Yep.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.